Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit. So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home. Because we can all get a good-looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon-grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
This is Sarah.
And Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. Today, we are going to ponder the future of the Republican Party. We're really excited to share our conversations with Mark McKinnon and Tim Miller. But before we get to that, we're going to tackle a couple of news stories, the COVID data reporting and, oh, God save us, the Wayfair conspiracy theories. So we're going to do all that. Before we dive in, we wanted to share that next week is the beginning of our How to Be a Citizen series. We are so excited. We get pragmatic, like how do you register for vote? How do you think about who you're going to vote for? All the way to super philosophical, should we have another constitutional convention? I'm here for it. I like the range of this series. I think everybody else will too.
And if you are with us over on Patreon, you're going to get some perspective from my 9 and 5-year-old about the 3 branches of government and partisanship and voting, as well as some coloring pages to work with as you listen to the series. We're just going to try to make this a family experience. Let's all sit down together and think about citizenship. And I'm very excited about it.
And you're doing deep dives on the Federalist Papers on Patreon throughout the series as well, which we're using as sort of foundational documents in our conversation.
Yes, they are difficult to read, which I have heard from a number of folks in our Extra Credit book club. So if you like the Supreme Court deep dives over on Patreon, we're going to do the same process with the Federalist Papers. Not all of them, there are 85. And, you know, I recognize that we all have our limits. But we're going to take 6 of them and go into a lot of detail. And those 6 really come up in our conversations throughout the series you're going to hear on the podcast.
We also want to welcome our newest executive producers, Nicole Berkles and Julie Haller. We're so touched by your support. Our entire executive producer team is just phenomenal, and we so appreciate all of you who make it possible for us to do what we do here at Pantsuit Politics, especially these longer, more complex episodes we've been producing lately, thanks to Dylan, Elise, and Simeon, and our patrons, because that is how we're able to bring you that kind of content.
So, let's talk about the number one news story many of y'all have been messaging us about, which is the Trump administration's changes to the process hospitals use to report their COVID data, how many ICU beds are used, how much of the current treatments they have available, how many people are on ventilators. So previously, that information went to the CDC, where it was publicly available. Now, through a private contractor, it is going through a system that will report it directly to the Department of Health and Human Services. And people have some concerns.
Well, I think those concerns are founded. And I also think that we are not going to live in a world where we have no visibility into these numbers. There are lots of groups working very hard to collect this data. In Kentucky, for example, our data is reported to the state health department directly from hospitals and testing facilities. And so this is a roadblock, and it is a big deal. And also, I don't want you out there thinking, well, now everything is going to be covered up.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of groups that are working really hard. The real problem here, well, I see two main problems. I'm interested in your perspective, Sarah. From a public health standpoint, we could talk about corruption in government, which I would like to do. But from a public health standpoint, I see two main problems. The first is switching systems in the middle of a crisis seems like a bad idea to me.
Yep.
Even if it's
that's exactly what I was going to say.
Even if it's the most amazing system that's ever been created, switching systems in the middle of a crisis, not a good idea.
No, and never a good idea.
The second problem is that CDC system has been in place for a long time. It's understood. It's been worked on. People know how to use it. Changing is going to complicate research. And we need research right now. And so I think this is really bad. I think it's extremely corrupt the way it's unfolded. But first, I would love to hear your thoughts, Sarah, on that public health component.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are real problems here, but the narrative cannot be the Trump administration is going to take the data and say there's no COVID-19, because I don't really think that that's the concern, because that data, the public health sharing of data like that is pretty robust and pretty agreed upon. And so I think we should focus on the really big problems here, which is it going to be publicly available? It is essential that they make it publicly available and that the process is transparent. But I also think we can't ignore the fact that there have been problems with the CDC system. And if we ignore that, then we miss the chance to make a really compelling argument around why we need solutions, but this is maybe not the best one. I mean, the CDC at one point was lumping active coronavirus with tests for recovered patients. And it was a really big deal. And it was a very big problem. And so we need to be honest about the CDC reporting system and say, okay, we see the issues, but the most important part is that it's well known and that it was publicly available. And so even if you solve every other issue, you know, trying to teach people a new system when their ICU beds are overflowing sounds like a wretched idea. Everybody remember healthcare.gov? Like, there's inevitable learning curves and tech malfunctions and system failures that we do not have time for right now. And so I just think that instead of making it about, oh, well, the Trump administration is going to make COVID-19 disappear, let's talk about, we see the problems. Now is not the time to fix them. And even if you move forward with this system, the public availability of the data is essential to us moving forward with research, vaccines, good treatments. And you cannot abandon that, and you cannot make it harder, not just for the hospitals to report it, but these researchers who are like in the thick of it right now, harder for them to get their hands on the data.
Totally agree. I also just need to mention, because this really bothers me, this new system was set up by a Pennsylvania company named Teletracking, which received a $10 million contract from the United States government in a non-competitive bidding process in April. And Senator Patty Murray from Washington has written a letter to the CDC asking why Teletracking received this contract on a non-competitive basis. All of this, I think, underscores the importance of trusting leadership. Because if we heard from the Obama administration or, I don't know, the George H.W. Bush administration in the middle of a crisis, hey, there are some flaws in the way we're getting this data today. We know that it is hard, but we are going to switch to a new system that we think will do a better job. Probably a lot of us would go, well, okay, hopefully that works. But here with this administration, our first instinct is, what are they trying to hide? And if we heard from one of those other administrations, because this was an emergency, we went with a company that has the best track record in the industry that the government has worked with before. They know our procedures. We know theirs. It was a non-competitive process. This is what we're doing. Probably most of us would have gone, well, okay, that makes sense. But with this administration that has so frequently awarded contracts in non-competitive processes, has so frequently selected vendors with no experience whatsoever in the thing they're receiving multi-million dollar federal contracts to do, my instinct is, okay, well, what's behind this? Who's on that board? Who's a shareholder? What are the connective pieces here? Because none of this makes sense to me. And it makes me sad that my first instinct is to suspect something nefarious every time this administration makes an announcement like this. But I also feel that my suspicion is grounded in the experience of the last 3 years.
Well, it seems like a lack of trust and the instinct to think something nefarious is going on is an excellent transition to the Wayfair cabinet conspiracy theory. Listen to that deep breath. Listen, audience. Listen to that. And maybe everybody should do that. That's probably a good idea right now.
That would be a good idea.
Oof. So if you don't have the internet, which congratulations, there has been a particularly aggressive viral conspiracy theory over the last week. It started in a Reddit thread when a user noticed some particularly expensive industrial cabinets on the Wayfair website with girl names attached to them and decided that this was a cover for child sex trafficking. And, you know, this theory of this one user fit very nicely in the larger QAnon / Pizzagate. There's a global elite trafficking in children worldview. I think there's also something to the fact that everybody's just stressed to the max right now. And it was a particularly susceptible environment to this particular conspiracy theory. And now it is everywhere. It is particularly aggressive on Instagram, which is not usually where you see this kind of stuff, which I think is interesting. You know, it swept up Tom Hanks at one point. It swept up Chrissy Teigen. It's everywhere.
I think that it is becoming more than one thing, and that's why it's crossing platforms too. I think that there is a strain of that QAnon worldview that is sort of the classic conspiracy theory. I don't know how to make sense of things, so I will come up with stories that are also like fun puzzles, and I feel like an investigator, and I feel like somebody who really gets what's going on when everybody around me is a sheep. And, you know, I think there's some classic, well-understood psychological stuff going on there. I also think it is pulling in people who are just chaos tourists, misogynists. Like, I about lost my mind yesterday on Chrissy Teigen's behalf. This probably indicates my stress level as well. Because I look at what's happened to her, and if you don't know, I mean, the woman cannot post a picture of a taco without just being assaulted. And as best I can tell, Chrissy Teigen seems like a lovely human being who enjoys being a mother and making yummy food and wearing bathing suits and living her life. And she is as funny and smart as she is glamorous. And you can't even be mad at her for it because she also tries to make the world a little bit better. And to see the relentless assault on her as this just like woman of color with a platform for no other reason than those things tells me that one piece of what's going on here is just, I don't want somebody like her being influential in this country. And then I think there's like a third thing sort of spreading into Instagram, where this universe of humans sees the writing on the wall for Trumpism and understands that if they want to keep these ideas alive, they are going to have to pull in more women. And I think that's why you see QAnon running women as candidates. And I think it's why you see things like Wayfair that pull in that demographic of people who have been mostly out of this kind of movement. That's my theory, at least.
Yeah, because there's this undercurrent of, well, we know that child sex trafficking is an issue. Yes, we do know that. And if it's an issue that you care deeply about, you should know that it's so prolific and so threatening that they don't need the cover of Wayfair to engage in it. You know, I had a local business owner arrested for soliciting an FBI agent for a child. And he was not offering $17,000. He was offering a bag of gummy bears. Okay? So the issue of, if you are sincerely swept up in this because you care and you're concerned about child sex trafficking, then go to the organizations that lead the fight on this. Learn about the issue. Learn about what makes children really susceptible. What types of children? What vulnerable populations do we need to be concerned about? Because it feels to me like this last holdout of good guys, bad guys. And if we can just root out these global elites, then we'll have protected children, which to me, it feels like the child aspect is just the last thing that, in theory, there's no partisanship around. Everybody wants to protect children from predators. And so that's what we're all going to glom on to, because that's the one thing that's kind of left. You know, you can't talk about the environment. You can talk about protecting Earth or protecting people's economic interests or religion. Like, there's no uniter anymore. So this is what we've got to, traffic in, no pun intended, is this idea that we all have to protect children, which is true. But it's complicated just like every other problem. There's no easy good guy, bad guy. We take out Jeffrey Epstein and all little girls are safe from predators. That's not ever going to be the case. And if you care about that, then educate yourself and know how we can start to deal with this problem and start to protect children. And let me tell you, going after Chrissy Teigen on Twitter doesn't protect a single child. And that's what bothers me about it. Like, it's just this false front of caring about kids that really, really gets to me.
Yeah, it's people using folks who genuinely care about kids for their own purposes. And, I think, look, if you...
And manipulating them.
If you read these stories and went, ooh, that is weird, that's okay. That's okay. Yep. That indicates that you are a person with a big heart who cares and that you don't want anything to be wrong in plain sight that you can help. And that's good. And then the next layer is, okay, let me just think for a second about whether it sounds right that a company as big and publicly scrutinized as Wayfair, because this is not Wayfair's first PR crisis, even in the last 6 months or so. A company like that, could this really be going on through that site? And then I think you watch how quickly it goes from, that seems like an awful lot of money for a cabinet, to some connection to George Soros or Ellen DeGeneres. And that's where, for me, it really unravels. Even if you thought at first, that seems weird, somebody should look into it. Once you hear the rest of the story and see how it connects to narratives that have been pushed over and over and over again in a certain community, that raises the suspicious flags big time. I read a really good piece by Mike Rothschild, who is one of a handful of folks who work deeply in following QAnon and other conspiracy theorist communities. And that is, first of all, let me just say, that is hard and awful work. NBC's reporter Ben Collins posted about how many of his colleagues are on like neo-Nazi hit lists, and that it's just a nightmare covering this stuff. And rarely does it bubble up to the headlines where people get credit for their work. So thank you, everybody who lives in the dark web. Thank you so much for doing that. But anyway, I read his piece and he said, why did this catch fire so quickly? Because these folks are conditioning you constantly to believe that there are no coincidences, there are no mistakes, there's no graphic design, everything is actually a symbol. And this just fit right in. It checked all those boxes. But when you dig into it a little bit, the pillow is not $11,000 unless you start putting weird customization letters in. That's a software problem. The cabinets are industrial grade cabinets. You know, people are already putting up GoFundMes saying, pitch in so we can buy one of these cabinets and figure out if it's real. That is a scam. That is a scam, you guys. And, you know, we just can't. I think there's a beautiful thing about wanting to trust the things that people in your life are talking about and caring about. I think you should stay in those relationships. It is also increasingly important that you be able to leave Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and find validation of the information you see there from sources that you've heard of 1,000 times over before you start to take it seriously.
Yep. Can we talk about one more aspect of the internet that really left me in a state?
Please.
So thanks to Jamie B. Golden, or no thanks to Jamie B. Golden, I started following Karen's Going Wilds. And here's the thing. I'm not unfamiliar with Karen's. I've seen the videos that came across the national news. But the depth and breadth of people engaging in this type of behavior, specifically people who will use the N-word to a perfect stranger in front of a cell phone camera, was mind-blowing to me. I felt a little bit like the first time I went to a party and everybody was drinking, and I just wanted to say, was I the only one paying attention in the morally responsible episodes of Growing Pains? Like, this is a bad idea, guys. And I see these videos of people being like, you need to go back to where you came from. You should be a slave. Like, was I the only one paying attention during Martin Luther King Day? And I'm the only American that internalized that all men are created equal, that we don't talk like that to our fellow citizens? Like, it's not, I'm a person that, you know, especially as a city commission, engage with my community. I heard people's individual stories of racism and discrimination. I read a lot about it. I think a lot about it. It's not like systemic racism is a surprise to me. But the level of hate was, I'm not going to lie, the level of hate blew my mind.
Can I tell you a thing that has blown my mind?
Yes.
I cannot believe that here in Kentucky, 87 people were charged with a felony for protesting at our attorney general's house in support of charges filed in the Breonna Taylor case.
Mm.
87 people were charged with a felony for a peaceful protest at our attorney general's house. What is going on? This is our same attorney general who is seeking court orders invalidating all of our governor's executive orders intended to protect from COVID-19. So I got lots to say about him in general.
File that and elections have consequences.
But yeah, absolutely. But, you know, when you talk about the Karen's Gone Wild and how could that be? To me, it can be because the legitimate forms of government, the democratically elected forms of government, are still telling us in so many ways, you just need to calm down about racism, everybody.
Yep. Well, even more explicitly supporting white supremacy. Let's
exactly
be honest.
Exactly.
That's what's unleashed this in my mind. is just the validation of, oh, yeah, your racial grievance, go for it. You're right. Spew that hate. Spew it. Because that's, you know, I was listening to an interview with Mary Trump, and somebody asked her, what makes your uncle so dangerous? And she said, he doesn't care what he destroys to get what he wants. And I see people acting like that, and to me it is. I don't think that Donald Trump is the only problem in the United States. Please let me be abundantly clear about that. But I do think that not only has he exposed problems we already had, but he unleashed. I mean, you watch that channel, it's like an exorcism. It's like people are, like, you expect at any moment for their heads to turn around backwards. And, like, I think the long-term stuff is income inequality, mental, the abandonment of mental health care. There's lots of layers to why people get to a state where they're willing to blame other groups with such hatred. But I don't know. I just feel like for so long there was at least these institutional agreements that kept some of this in place, and he just unleashed it all.
And then he knows how to use all of our concerns. I mean, this gets back to the Wayfair conspiracy. The things that we are most afraid of are always used against us. I was losing my mind in my bedroom this morning to my long-suffering husband about the death penalty cases and the two executions that have happened. Because just for a little review, we reinstated the federal death penalty in 1988, which is shameful in my view. And between 1988 and this week, three people were killed by the federal government. Three. We have four executions scheduled from the beginning of July to the end of August.
Ugh.
And the person who was killed this morning, as we are recording, was 68 years old and has Alzheimer's and committed his crime 22 years ago. And I don't know who is served by that. The person who was killed a couple days ago, the family of the victims practically begged the court not to execute him. They said it would only exacerbate their pain. I don't know who is served by that. But what I do know is what my husband reminded me of, which is Bill Barr and the Trump administration are doing this again to distract, to have something else to talk about, to speak to people's fears. And when you look at what the Department of Justice has put out about resuming these executions, it is the most gruesome descriptions of the crimes these people have committed. And they are gruesome. They are heinous. They are wrong and messed up on every level. And still, the fact that our government is killing them decades after they committed the crimes makes absolutely no sense to me. But I think getting back to why are conspiracy theorists obsessed with pedophilia and child sex trafficking, I think it's because when you want people to follow you, you speak to their most deeply held fears and concerns.
Yep. Yep. That's what I was talking to a friend about this, and she said, I think people are so afraid. And I said, yeah, and fear and hatred are two sides of the same coin. And right now, it feels like it's the only currency in America. And it's just so hard and frustrating. And that's why, honestly, I'm really excited to move into our series the next few weeks, because I think we need a big dose of, we know it's hard right now. We have to think about what the future could look like. It's really important for us to do that, because if we soak ourselves in the hatred and fear of this particular moment, it, you know, not only doesn't help us get out of it, but certainly doesn't help us get to somewhere better.
You know, because I think that the call to action here is not to not be afraid. There are a lot of things to be afraid of right now. There are a lot of scary things. There are a lot of unknowns. We have all the information the world has ever known on our phones, basically, in our pockets. And yet we are confronting things that we do not understand. And that's a tough one, you know? So it's okay. But as Sarah's favorite, Oprah Winfrey, says, you know, courage is being afraid and going on. And so I think that's the call to action. Let's be afraid of whatever we're afraid of, but then keep moving forward instead of being stuck in that fear and letting it control us, which is, I don't know, a sadly poignant transition as we talk about the future of the Republican Party.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reeds. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance through high-quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit. Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting. We sat down to have this conversation. We knew we had to talk to Mark McKinnon. He is an American political advisor, has worked for both parties, a reform advocate, and most recently a part of the hit Showtime show, The Circus. And so we sat down with Mark and asked him, from his vantage point, what the future of the Republican Party looks like and what all these movements inside the Republican Party, these anti-Trump movements, are trying to do.
I have somewhere in the neighborhood of 70,000 questions for you about everything that's going on.
I got time for 65,000.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. I was thinking about 2016, actually, in getting ready to talk with you and thinking about a particular episode of The Circus called The Prisoner's Dilemma.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember watching you talking with your co-host on The Circus about the obvious fact that someone was going to have to drop out and consolidate so that people could consolidate by an alternative to Trump. And I wonder, as you think back to that moment and roll forward to where we are today, looking at groups like the Lincoln Project, like Republican Voters Against Trump, all these efforts by people who were really, in my view, the heart of the party pre-Trump, how do you connect those things in your mind?
Well, I mean, I connect them by, I mean, Trump ran as a, you know, as Jeb Bush said, as the chaos candidate, mm-hmm. and then he became the chaos president. He was the ultimate mm-hmm. disruptor. He was the ultimate change candidate running against the ultimate status quo candidate in Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, Donald Trump never thought he was going to be president. You know, that's why all these legal problems are so problematic. He knew all that stuff was out there. He just never thought he was going to have to deal with it. He thought that it would be good for his brand to, he understood, rightly so, that if you want to get a bunch of attention, the biggest spotlight in the world is to run for president. He thought he'd go do that for a while. And we know from our reporting that he had intended to do that for 3 or 4 or 5 months and then endorse Chris Christie for president. Hmm. And he just kept winning. And the, I mean, he won because he was a disruptor and a change agent and a candidate of kind of status quo establishment Republicans. And there's just a great hunger for something completely different. And people just didn't really realize just how different it was going to be. And then didn't take long after he was president for a lot of the establishment Republicans to realize that Trump was antithetical to their interests and their ideology and their history. And so it's not a surprise that these groups have formed. And it's not that these kind of groups haven't formed before in the past. This is just the first time they've been really effective and well-funded. So, I mean, the first thing is that, A, they're like serious. When they've happened in the past, they've been like 4 or 5 people and they raise a few $100 and put up one ad and that's about it. I saw that the Lincoln Project had just raised $16 million. Republican Voters Against Trump has got, I think, 9 million subscribers online and getting tons of videos of former Republican voters are being sent in. That's very effective. And now there's even a 43 group, people who work for George W. Bush. So those are three significant efforts that involve like real players. And it's been effective because they're smart strategists, two, they're well-funded. And three, they know how to get into the head of the president. I mean, the one thing, I've worked on both sides of the aisle. The one thing the Republicans are just much better at doing is attacking. I mean, they're ruthless mm-hmm. and shameless. And so they're just really good at it. And they're fast and furious. And Democrats will sit around and wring their hands and worry about who they're offending. And meanwhile, Republicans will just start taking heads off.
Here's my question, though. I remember in 2016, I think it was Ezra Klein that said, everything, sort of the overall strategies, when they were attacking each other, when they were attacking Democrats, when they were selling their platform to the public, there was sort of, you know, if you're Mitch McConnell, it's, oh, we got to work on the corruption in Washington, and these Democrats are a threat to our American values and all this stuff. And it was sort of with a wink, right? A wink and a nod. And then Trump came along and there was no winking. And I think there was this sense among the base of like, well, you've been telling us that this is do or die. All the stuff's on the line for decades. And, you know, we haven't overturned Roe v. Wade and we haven't did all these things that you keep selling candidates to us as the solution to this, you know, fundamental, essential breakdown of American values. And so, you know, you might have been winking, but we weren't. And this guy's not winking, so we're going with him. And I wonder with these groups, you know, I hear the Lincoln Project saying, well, we're going after the party needs a clean break. And I hear them saying that, and I like the sound of it. But I'm like, you guys know, and we know that this started before Trump, but he took advantage of an environment that had been built over decades. And so when you say we want a clean break and we're going after Republican senators and we're going to undo a lot of this, you know, even to what you said, like the willingness to attack and the willingness to, like, are you really, do you see that there's a reexamination of the tactics that led to Trump, or is it just this, we got to take our party back from Trump?
I think it's just we got to take the party back and mm-hmm. do it at all costs. And, you know, Trump, you know, for his base has done what he promised, but for, you know, Republicans who are, you know, longtime Republicans and have been working for the party for a long time, he's abandoned you know, a lot of the fundamental principles. Yeah, he's been good on judges and he's been good on a couple of other things, but on trade and, you know, a lot of other things that are fundamental, you know, people were against Trump before he was elected and they got even, you know, more opposed to him after he was elected. So I think there's going to be, well, there's already a reckoning about the future of the Republican Party. And if Trump loses, that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch, the rehabilitation of the party.
It just seems like such a journey to me from that prisoner's dilemma where we couldn't even consolidate around one non-Trump option to making ads in support of Joe Biden, and not just Joe Biden, but his down ballot, you know, companions that they're trying to take out Republican senators. And I wonder, like, do you think the feeling of fast, furious rage that comes through these ads is genuine, or is that just applying the playbook in the direction that makes the most sense right now?
Oh, I think it's genuine. I think people feel that the party's been hijacked. And part of the reason the party's been hijacked is not just Trump, but the people who've served him.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a reckoning not just for Trump, but the people who facilitated all this. So in their view, it's better to make a clean sweep and start from scratch, burn the house down.
So you have that great perspective, not just because of your work with both parties, but I think your work on the circus. So why do you think in 2020 on the Democratic side, the prisoner's dilemma worked and they said, all right, we're going to consolidate because we don't want Bernie. So what are we going to do here? And didn't work in 2016 on the Republican side.
Well, you could say that it did work for the Republican side. They elected a president, you know.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, they beat Hillary Clinton. And so, in a sense, I mean, the prisoner's dilemma on the Democratic side this time, it was pretty fascinating to watch because, as you know, Biden...
I didn't think we had it in us, I'll be honest. I did not think we had that level of organization in us.
I thought, you're going to blow it, and like the Democrats always do. And that was a remarkable 72-hour period because Biden had really struggled, you know, for obvious reasons. He's old, he's establishment, all of that. But, you know, it was just, and it was, we came really close to getting Bernie Sanders as the nominee, which, you know, maybe in the current environment, any Democrat can win, but it sure would have been harder for Sanders. And I certainly wouldn't be happy about it. And I know a lot of my colleagues wouldn't. And it'd been harder for people like Lincoln Project and these others to be fanning the flames with somebody like Bernie Sanders out there. But, you know, you're right. I mean, the Democrats for once kind of pulled together. And, you know, I think if Joe Biden's elected, you guys should just, you know, make Jim Clyburn a saint. You know, that guy. I mean, Joe Biden owes him everything if he's elected president, because he's the guy that made it happen. And he's a really remarkable character. It was fun to be around him in South Carolina. He's a wise old dude, man.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if it was just that. To me, it's an argument for what we talk about a lot on Pansy Politics, which is, you know, nobody likes to talk about smoke-filled rooms, and they're really unpopular for obvious reasons.
Well, the other thing
is parties are not supposed to be wholly democratic. Like, there's supposed to be some leadership that knows what's going on, that's pulling the levers, that can see, that has a different perspective than your average voter, a Jim Clyburn that can come in and be like, no, let me show you. I know how this plays out, and we're not going that direction.
Well, that's what was kind of unusual and unique for the time about it is you're right. I mean, the smoke-filled rooms don't really exist like they used to. You couldn't just have kind of a party figure make a pronouncement and have a bunch of people follow them. But that's, you know, it's a little bit of South Carolina. It's just kind of throwback and old school, but, you know, it sure worked for this time around. And it's what the party needed at the right time.
I wanted to ask you about that thought experiment of what if it had been somebody besides Joe Biden? It seems to me that Joe Biden is like uniquely conducive to support from old school Republicans.
100%.
If it weren't Bernie Sanders, but one of the many other options on the Democratic side of the aisle, what do you think this effort might look like?
Well, I'd just reverse it a little bit and say, you know, that Joe Biden is just a guy that people like me and, you know, a lot of establishment Republicans and independents feel very comfortable about. I mean, he's a, you know, he's a very centrist guy. you know, he's been resisting, you know, I mean, he's evolving obviously, but he's resisting going, you know, full fledged crazy off the, you know, leftward cliff, and which is good because it's going to help attract, you know, those Republicans and independents that will be necessary to win in the fall. So the other thing is that it's really hard for Trump to attack him because people know him.
Yeah.
It's just like, wait a minute, that's Joe Biden. I've known this guy, you know, I've watched this guy for 20 years, you know? And so whatever Trump may say about him, people have an experience with him. And the irony is that, you know, the great disruptor and the great change agent is still running as a change agent as president, which is unusual. But Joe Biden, who is, you know, is again kind of another status quo candidate like Clinton, but he's in this time of COVID, people are looking for something safe and familiar and a guy who's been around and knows the levers of government. So all those things are positives for Biden. And you know, there were other Democratic candidates who may have been, you know, more attractive than Bernie. But Biden, I mean, you know, listen, I think the one thing that Trump did get right was recognize that Biden was his biggest problem early on. And that, you know, that's why he tried to get, you know, Ukraine to do his dirty business for him, because he recognized early on that what a big threat Biden is. And you can see that they're struggling now. They can't figure out how to run against him.
Yeah. Well, and I think from the impeachment, and I wonder if this is what Jim Clyburn and other party leaders saw, we were so obsessed with how the impeachment didn't take out Donald Trump and how some of these accusations didn't stick to Donald Trump. But the truth of the matter is that they were also not sticking to Biden, that was not impacting his brand. That was not impacting his reputation either. And I don't know if Trump saw that, or I don't know if that was part of Clyburn's calculations. But, you know, looking back on it, I'm like, yeah, he walked right out of that, too. And I mean, I just think some of this is, yeah, people know Biden, but when I look at the Lincoln Project and I think about what feels different to me than last time when we had Never Trump people in 2016 as well, is that we know Trump too. Like, so much of the element of surprise of, well, he won't do that, is gone. It's like George Will. No, he has no bottom. Always assume he can get worse. You know, like, I think that to me is what feels different, is not only that people trying to attack him and get under his skin and figure out what works, like, they got a lot more data, like, there's a better understanding of who he is and how he operates, but I think that's true of even voters as well.
Yeah, Washington columnist said, we always know what the worst day for Trump is going to be, tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So I just think do you see that?
Yeah.
That awareness of, like, what works and what doesn't playing out with these Lincoln projects. Like, it seems like their strategies seem different to me than the Never Trump attempts in 2016.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're mostly just screwing with him. And some of the Republican voters against Trump stuff is designed to truly persuade conservative leaning voters that the Lincoln Project, mostly just a psychological nuclear bomb that goes off every other day for Trump just to distract him. And it works pretty well because he gets their attention. I mean, that's the kind of thing that George Bush would have paid zero attention to.
Yeah.
He would have completely ignored it. And Barack Obama would have too.
Mm-hmm.
But Trump,
and that's the thing. He has no, when I think it was Thune or somebody came out and was like, he really needs to shift strategies. We really need him to, you know, pay attention to this and not do that. And I just wanted to be like, who are you talking to? He can't change. He it's not a strategy. It's who he is. He has no other approaches. That's it. What you see is what you get. And listen, maybe that's what people responded to in 2016, but like, he's not going to all of a sudden become, like you said, like George Bush or Barack Obama and like put on the presidential hat and not get involved in these like attack ads on him. Like, he just doesn't have it in him.
No, he doesn't. But the problem is that the campaign is constantly trying to shift tactics and strategies. And, the one thing that we learned in the 2004 campaign, and David Plouffe sort of gave a hat tip to in terms of the way they ran their operation too, was that even a flawed, consistent strategy is better than a strategy that changes
it. Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening with Trump now. So, you know, they're trying to change his nickname. They're just trying, you know, they're throwing shit against the wall and nothing's sticking. And so they're trying to throw something else, you know, every day, and it's not working. And, they'll shift personnel, they'll shift messages, they'll shift nicknames. which is all problematic because that sends a signal that they don't have a clear strategy. And of course, the worst thing is that on a couple of occasions, Trump has asked what his rationale is for a second term, and he has not.
We also spent some time with Tim Miller, who is a contributor to The Bulwark. He is the political director for Republican Voters Against Trump. He previously was the communications director for Jeb Bush, and he's just somebody that I have followed for a long time. It meant a lot to me to talk to Tim Miller because when Jeb Bush dropped out of the 2016 race, there wasn't even a second where Tim Miller said, well, I guess we're getting on the Trump train now. He is somebody who's put a lot on the line career-wise in a very real way to say this is not what conservative principles are supposed to be. And we were just really thrilled to get this chance to hear his views on Republican Voters Against Trump. You know, we have a lot of listeners who are really interested in Republican Voters Against Trump and the Lincoln Project. And I have been following your work pretty closely since Jeb's campaign. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested to see how you know, consistently, like from the moment Jeb dropped out, we're like, not Trump, and have stuck with that. And I would love to just hear about sort of how you got involved with Republican Voters Against Trump, sort of the journey from 2016 to today.
Yeah, well, after Jeb dropped out, I was laying on the beach in Miami, and I was planning on spending a couple of weeks doing just that, you know, nursing my wounds and getting tan, reading some crashy fiction. And then I got a phone call from a group that was at the time, it was called Our Principles Pack, and they were going to try to stop Trump in the 2016 primary, and they needed a spokesperson. And you know, honestly, like it felt like a no-brainer to me. Trump failed every imaginable character leadership test that I could have put forth for a candidate. He was never going to be a starter for me, you know, dating back to birtherism and the Muslim ban, his racism, his lack of interest in the fundamental American values. And so I kind of jumped on that. And then I asked around to a few other folks. And that was my first wake up call that maybe everybody didn't agree with me on this, because a lot of people thought I was crazy for doing that and ruining my career or whatever. But I did it anyway. And so, you know, like you said, I stuck with it. Fast forward 3 years, or maybe fast forward 1 year after he won the presidency, I kind of went to a dark hole for a couple of months, and some friends, Bill Kristol and Sarah Longwell, started this group Defending Democracy Together. I was happy that they were doing that, but I needed a little break. And you know, as we head up to this election, I got with them to talk about what, you know, their plans were for DDT. And you know, we got to talking about starting this group, Republican Voters Against Trump, and it was based a lot on the research that Sarah had been doing. Talking to Trump voters who you know were gettable, and asking them, you know, what persuades them, you know, testing ads, you know, learning about, you know, why they liked him, what they didn't like about him. And that's where this program, you know, came out of. You heard that a lot of these voters, you know, had anti-elite sentiments. That shouldn't be surprising. And so getting lectured to from DC was not very helpful. They would tune out immediately a lot of ads, you know, as soon as it seemed too nasty. But they were at least open to hearing and listening to messages when it came from people like them, people that were conflicted, people that had given Trump a chance. And so that basically was the impetus for the program. And I was, you know, excited to get involved with them and help them with that.
It seems to me like there's two groups that come up a lot in this conversation.
Yep.
You have the Republican voter, you're every man, every woman, you know, they usually live in Michigan, and then we're particularly obsessed with them. But I think that conversation also includes his base, which felt like to me in 2016, I felt like the conversation was, well, there's this silent majority. There's these people that really love Trump that won't talk about it. I think those people still exist to a certain extent. But now the conversation in 2020 seems to have really shifted to his base, and where we see behavior like a loyalty, I don't know, like a just obsession with him that you don't usually see even in the most passionate basis. I mean, that, and I think it's really affecting down ballot Republicans because of that behavior of the base. Does that seem right to you? Does it seem like it's shifted? Is there anything somebody interested in saving the Republican Party can do when, I'm not sure how big the percentage is, but a pretty big percentage is that base that's just obsessed with him?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, I wrote about this for Rolling Stone. I called a bunch of consultants who are still in the game. Obviously, I went too anti-Trump. And so, you know, no Republicans are going to hire me and I'm not going to work for most of them. So I'm out of the game a little bit on political consulting. But I called a bunch of my old, you know, friends and rivals and colleagues and just asked them, what's the state of play? And I heard this over and over again, that look, that he has this, you know, religious-like devotion from parts of the base. One of the consultants said that, you know, he gets Saddam Hussein-like numbers mm-hmm. in rural parts of the country. And so, you know, there's this tension, right? Because those people, he had them in 2016 too, but he also won over a lot of voters that were, I forget who coined this term, called them the haters. Voters that didn't really like Trump, didn't like Hillary either. A lot of those folks went for Trump last time. Some of those were these sort of silent majority folks that you're talking about. Some of them would be happy to talk about it. They just were grossed out by both candidates and just thought he was a better bet.
Yeah.
And so the problem is that this time, as you look to 2020, if you're a down ballot candidate, like you got to appeal to both those groups, and they have totally divergent views on this presidency. You know, the one group wants you to just compliment everything, and the other group is kind of like, ooh, I'm pretty worried about the tweets and his handling of the virus and how rude he's been on the George Floyd protests. And so it's tough to appeal to both those parts of the electorate. And I do think that, you know, the first group wins out because it's a majority. I think it's a slight majority, but, you know, it's 50-60% of the party that wants you to just be totally devoted. Maybe a little more if you look only at the primary electorate. One person told me it was 80% of the primary electorate that are just Trump loyalists. And then if you get to a general election electorate, you know, 60% maybe.
But that's, you know, when Beth sent me that article, I thought I knew what was going to be in the Rolling Stone piece. Like, as somebody who lives and works in D.C., I thought I knew what they were going to say, because I think that's the different group that we have this conversation around. Like, we have the Republican voter and then the base, and we have Republican elites and Republican politicians and the people in D.C. And I thought I knew what they were going to say to you off the record. And I was blown away by the tribalism and the hatred of the left and the feeling he's bad. Like, I mean, did that shock you or did you expect it? And what does that say for the future of the party?
Yeah, honestly, I was kind of surprised. So of the consultants I talked to, they were in kind of three camps, right? Some of them have like basically put on the red hat. And so you knew what you were going to get, you know, and then some of them were pretty much don't like Trump, but this is their career they've chosen. And so they're sticking with it, right? And so neither, I heard about what I expected from those folks. It was just the middle ground, you know, people that I didn't really know that much about, and that, you know, when we're in social settings, we don't talk about Trump because everybody knows what my view is, right? And it was really fascinating to hear from them, because to a person, they were all just, the media is out to get us, the never Trumpers are assholes, the far left is going crazy, and they're going to, you know, add three states and take down George Washington's monuments. And, you know, they call me a racist, and, you know, they're everything's so woke. And I was like, I was like, really? I almost wanted to argue with them, but I wanted to learn. I just, the whole point in the process was to learn what they thought. So I tried not to argue, but, you know, it was like, wow. I mean, really? I don't share that view. And I think that there's this bubble that's been created around Republican consultants in D.C. that they all kind of tell each other this, right? That we have to, you know, that the left is bad, the media is out to get us, the never Trumpers are assholes. And so there's not a lot of reflection going on about Trump's own behavior. And I just don't know. I just don't know that I agree. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I look at the left and see, you know, that Joe Biden won this primary in a landslide. So yep. I don't really see the radicalism. You know, I don't agree with Joe Biden on a lot of things, but I don't see him as a radical, or the base of the Democratic Party has gone crazy. I see the base of the Republican Party has gone crazy.
It's kind of comforting to me to hear you say that, because as I've watched this unfold, you know, I voted for Republicans always until Trump.
Yeah.
And I never ever felt that hostility about Democrats just as a regular voter. And now I feel like that hostility is the almost the reason for being of the party.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm really confused by it. And I have wondered, like, was that always animating this? And I was just a sucker for it. because people like Tim Miller are good at their jobs, or is that new?
Well, I don't want to speak for you, but I'll speak for me. I also didn't share this personal loathing for the, you know, Obama folks. I was friends with a lot of Obama folks. You know, we went out and had drinks after, you know, debate nights and stuff, and where we'd argue on Twitter and we disagree on things. But I didn't have a loathing for them. I didn't think Obama was ruining the country. And I do think I underestimated, and this is something that I have regrets about, how genuine a lot of the party base, and I guess some of my peers really in the consultant class, did feel that Obama was fundamentally ruining the country. And they believed in a very genuine way, you know, some of the whatever Oppo research we would put out, and, you know, some of these hits on Obama that, you know, maybe I would attack him and have a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek method of attacking him. A lot of them took it very seriously. And honestly, I have regrets about it because I should have seen it. I mean, it was there with the birtherism. It was there. I remember having conversations with people who I thought were pretty rational, and it would turn out they actually believed the birtherism stuff. I would get blindsided by that. And like, that should have been, I look back on it and say, there should have been some warnings here that folks were going off the deep end on some of this stuff.
Well, and let me just, as a lifelong Democrat and somebody who worked in Washington, D.C., Republicans don't have a monopoly on animosity, especially during W's presidency.
No doubt.
There was a mood of, he is a threat. They are, you know, not to be trusted. They are disingenuous about everything. But it never felt to me like, you know, I think it was a part of what got us here as much as the animosity on the right. But there was still this line. There was still this, you know, it wasn't everybody. Especially I felt like in Congress, there was a sense of like, you have your outliers, but the majority of people here are sort of like, you know, the John McCain camp, and everybody can get on board and I'll work with them. I mean, you kind of hear it in the sense of like, you hear it when senators speak, you hear it when Durbin speaks, you hear it like, I feel like there's just a loss of any congeniality, any like benefit of the doubt is just gone. It is gone among the political class in DC. And I think it's more dangerous when it comes to the Republican Party, because I just think they have a demographic reckoning coming their way. And I want two parties. I really do. Yeah. And I think it's important for our democracy. And if they don't think they can win ever, or they see this demographic reckoning and there's just no willingness to pay attention to the long term, like, what is the long term fallout of this? Even if you think Donald Trump wins a second term, he can't live forever. What is Donald Trump Jr.? Like, what is the long-term plan here, guys? Like, I'm worried. I'm really worried.
Yeah. I mean, I will say this. I was with you, too, on the Democratic outrage to Bush that I thought was a lot of times hyperbole. You know, of course, you know, with the Iraq War kind of being the exception, like, there was a lot of fair outrage about that. But, you know, I think that there were a lot of times when it was overkill. But then, you know, we went ahead and nominated Donald Trump, and I started to think, well, I don't know, maybe the Democrats actually were seeing clearly, and it was me that had my head in the sand. You know,
maybe we weren't crying, shaking little.
Yeah, we are what they thought we were, whatever that the old line is from the football coach. So, as far as the future is concerned, look, I'm pessimistic for this reason. There's been a big shift in the makeup of the parties over the last 4 years. And a lot of the voters who in Republican primaries would have been moderating influences, these maybe some listeners of this podcast, you know, suburban women, college educated women in particular, who are swing voters, the famous, you know, security moms for W. These people are Democrats now, you know. Okay, they're Democrats, and they went out in huge numbers for Joe Biden in that primary. And then while those folks have left the party, an influx of, you know, former union guys who don't really care that much about, you know, conservative economics or you know, national security, you know, these two legs of the Republican stool that are, you know, filled with cultural grievance against the elites, they've come into the party. All right. And so now, you know, if you look ahead to future primaries, you know, in a lot of places, you know, there are exceptions to this, but Republican candidates are going to have to appeal to a base now that is less educated, more white, more rural, more culturally aggrieved, less caring about conservative principles. that is not a path, you know, that to me does not look like a party that's going back to Nikki Haley, right? To me. Now, obviously all this stuff can change. It's hard to predict, but that's the thing that concerns me the most is that the makeup of the parties have changed. And this is a bottom up problem, not a top down problem with the Republican Party.
Well, I want to ask you then what you see as the goal. I love how Republican Voters Against Trump is tackling this problem. It feels to me like they, more than the Lincoln Project or Project Lincoln, are really trying to speak to people who are persuadable. I think Project Lincoln is smart and interesting for a number of reasons, but it feels more like preaching to the converted. So what is the goal, as you see it, of Republican Voters Against Trump, and how's it going as we move toward that goal?
As far as Project Lincoln is concerned, I just want to say this. I think one thing they're doing that's really important is leveling the playing field. You know, Donald Trump played on a very uneven playing field last time because he was playing by one set of rules, and the Democrats and Jeb and Marco and all of us were playing by a different set.
Yep.
And I think the Lincoln Project is saying, well, we're going to play by your set of rules. Okay. So yeah. I think that's a very important additive thing that they're bringing to the table in addition to other stuff they're doing. But yeah, look, as far as our group is concerned, we have one mission, and that's beating Donald Trump. And we want to, you know, attract as many voters as possible who can help us with that. And so, you know, this is based in research. As I said, it's based in testing. But the other thing it is we're actually trying to talk to a little bit of a different demo than they are in some ways. We want the person that might be a Joe Biden, Tom Tillis voter in North Carolina to hear our message. And we want to try to persuade them, right? Whereas the Lincoln Project, I think, is trying to rip off Joe Biden and Tom Tillis's face. And so what we've found is if you look at the kind of demographic groups here, you have a group of voters that maybe voted for Donald Trump last time, but still really consider themselves conservative and Republican, and they just voted against Hillary. And maybe we can help persuade them to just throw their vote away. And that's a plus one for Joe Biden, right? And then you've got a group of suburban people that last time maybe said, I'm going to vote for Evan McMullen. Now we can move them over to Joe Biden. That's a plus one for Joe Biden. That's the same. You know, so talking to these Trump voters, that's why we called it Republican Voters Against Trump and why it was a very specific name, because we want to be able to attract these folks that still really kind of consider themselves Republicans and conservatives.
What do you think about the scorched earth from Project Lincoln, the sort of let's take the Senate too? I can't decide if it is necessary to torch this house in order to save it, or if the more, hey, you know, stick with your Congress people, but let's get Trump out and then we'll take the next step from there is a better approach.
It's a tough one, right? Because here's my problem is Donald Trump to me is so atrocious on his face, and he's so unfit, and he's doing so much damage to the fabric of our country that, like, the idea that you think that Donald Trump should serve another term in office is a disqualifying thing, I think, for me in supporting you ever again. It's just such a bad judgment call. I mean, you know, it's one thing to say, well, we disagree on what the tax rate should be, or, you know, which month we should start to have restrictions on abortion, or, you know, they're all regulation. There are all these issues I think we can all disagree on in good faith. It, your judgment is demonstrated to be so bad if you think that Donald Trump should be the president for another 4 years. So I feel that way on one side. On the other side, you know, I don't think that it's realistic. You know, it's kind of wish casting to think that, like, we're going to scalp all these guys and start new with a new moderate, diverse Republican Party. So I think it'll have to be a case by case basis. And I think that the reality is the Republican Party is going to have a Trump imprint on it for a while. And maybe people like me just aren't a part of that. And so, you know, I think that everybody who's been part of this should be held accountable for the fact that they were part of it. But I think that this idea that we're going to just, you know, salt the earth and take over the party with a bunch of never Trump rhinos is pretty wishful thinking at best.
Well, and it's just like, what should be your top priority? Susan Collins or the new class of QAnon congressional representatives coming our way? You know, like, I don't know. I don't know what's a bigger threat.
Yeah. Again, I mean, from my perspective, like Trump, let's get rid of Trump and then deal with the rest later.
I totally understand the perspective that's like, all these folks have to pay and I have bloodlust. That resonates with me, but I'm focused on one guy.
Well, I wonder too, I'm the person you described. So I voted for Evan McMullen, then I became a Democrat. And I think probably for a generation, people like me, the security moms, we're gone.
Yeah, they're out.
And so maybe we just don't come back. Do you think that means something new builds?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that what we saw in 2018 was a lot of folks that were maybe the Evan McMullen crowd already basically switched sides, and became mm-hmm. Democrats in the midterms. There are, I think, some counterexamples to that. There definitely has been a magnet back to the party for some folks who, you know, look at the squad and all these random cultural issues and decide that Donald Trump is somebody they can stomach. But for the most part, a lot of these third party voters moved in 2018. And so when you look at the electorate this time, I think this is underappreciated. Joe Biden can win this election without winning one Obama-Trump voter back, without adding one African-American voter or young voter in the urban centers in these swing states that didn't vote for Hillary. All he has to do is win the voters who last time looked at both candidates and said, I'm sitting this one out. And if you
and
look
he does
at the
great
numbers,
in that polling.
Yeah, he does.
That
he does great
for him.
Yeah, so if you look at Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, there's 100,000 plus voters in all those states who are not traditional third party voters, who last time just sat it out. But if Biden wins those folks, he's the president. It is a super important slice of the electorate that I think gets a little lost in the media coverage as compared to the vaunted working class Obama Trump voter sitting in the diner.
So let's say Donald Trump loses. Please, God, let Donald Trump lose. God willing. What is next for somebody who cares, who still considers themselves a Republican? Like, what's next for Republican voters against Trump?
I think we probably have an amicable breakup. Honestly, I think that there are some people in that group who look at the Democratic Party and say, I'm going to fight for the center in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And I identify more like an Alyssa Slotkin type Democrat now, yeah. Basically. I think that there are some people that will look at the Republican Party and say, I can stomach Nikki Haley. She grossed me out with how much she sucked up to Trump. But like on the grand scheme of things, I can get past it. And I want to fight for the Republican Party. And in realistic terms, Nikki Haley is the best bet. I mean, the idea that some never Trumper like, Larry Hogan is going to be the 2024 nominee. I mean, I guess somebody can fight for that. But I think that's wishful thinking. And then I think that there will probably be a group, I think a lot of the Lincoln Project guys feel this way, that feel like maybe there's a third option and this is the right time for the country. Mm-hmm. We've gotten so polarized. And I've always been pretty pessimistic on third parties historically, but, I do think eventually this rubber band snaps, and if you get to a 2024 election or 2028, where the Democrats do lose control of their party to kind of the Bernie wing. I think a lot of things are changing in our politics right now. So yeah. I think there's probably a split up between those three camps. It will probably depend a lot on, how the Democrats act and whether they stick with the sort of Biden style Democrats or whether, he gets co-opted. And it depends a little bit on how much Trump loses. If Texas tips over, maybe there's a real reckoning. If he gets killed that much in a close election, I think they blame it on coronavirus and just kind of run the whole thing back.
Do you have time for one more?
Of course.
I was really interested in John Weaver's comment in the Washington Post piece about Never Trumpers, that the next phase is to deal with people like Tucker Carlson. It seems to me that if there is to be a viable third option, that it has to be nurtured by a new form of conservative media. And I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I thought the backlash against Weaver's comments were kind of weird, to be honest. I mean, shock. Never Trump Republicans don't want the party to be taken over by a bunch of nativist, nationalist assholes like Tucker Carlson. And it's going to be a fight that continues to be fought. I think that's kind of self-evident. And so I just think the question is whether that's a fight that happens within the Republican Party or whether it's a fight that happens kind of from the outside.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time and for everything that you're doing out there. How are you feeling about things, Mark, just in general? Like, are you happy with what you're doing and where you are? What do you think matters right now in your career as you look at this whole thing? Because I know you care about the landscape a lot.
Well, I'm a prisoner of hope. You know, I keep pushing a big rock up a very steep hill with kind of reform things that I do and advocate for. And I just, you know, I've learned that progress may be incremental, but as long as it's forward, it's worth the effort. Mm-hmm. And the more existential these issues become, the more important it is to maintain the fight.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once-daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study, and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo, and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code PANTSUIT50 at factormeals.com/PANTSUIT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15. I want to be sure to say, if you have not gone to the Republican Voters Against Trump website, please do that, because it really has better answers for many of you who write to us saying, how do I talk to my relatives, than we do. When you hear people in their own words saying, I voted for Trump in 2016, here's why, here's where I am today, and those people are a hugely diverse group of individuals speaking with a lot of sincerity and humility, it's a really compelling case that they're making. So be sure to check their work out.
So Beth, after we talked to both of them, what do you think the future of the Republican Party looks like?
I'm not optimistic. So someone like me is gone, right? I'm not I can't imagine a version of the Republican Party in my lifetime that I go back to. Because as Bill Kristol said in an op-ed on Thursday, realistically, rebuilding the GOP after a Trump loss would have to involve many of the people who have enabled, propped up, supported Donald Trump. And that's not something that is ever going to work for me. And I think none of those people are going to allow the Tim Millers and the Project Lincoln guys and the Sarah Longwells back into the fold to help them rehabilitate because there's so much animosity between those groups. And so my feeling is that maybe a third option emerges, or maybe it just becomes about what it means to be a Democrat. You know, for me, if being a Democrat means that I get to support people like Amy McGrath, MJ Hegger, Abigail Spanberger, Alyssa Slotkin, I'm good. I can have some disagreements here and there, but I'm satisfied and I feel represented and I feel comforted that we have those kind of competent, serious professionals, people with a deep understanding of national security, people who have a demonstrated ability to work across the aisle when it matters. That feels really good to me. So I think more depends on what happens in the Democratic Party in some ways to the emergence of that third party than what happens on the GOP side, because I'm just not sure there's any capable movement on the GOP side. There is also this important wing of the Democratic Party who thinks all those people that I just listed are not progressive enough, right? And so where that other option comes from, I don't know. And I think that's okay. I'm okay being in an I don't know period.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the truth is the future of the Republican Party is hard to talk about without the future of the entire party system. And I think that a third party alternative could definitely come up on the progressive left just as much as it could come up from the Republican side of the aisle. I don't think that there is a way to rehabilitate the Republican Party post-Trump, because I think much of what led to Trump was baked in. He was a manifestation of some real toxicity within the Republican Party, within the appeal they were making to particularly rural voters, older voters, that fear-based argument. And I don't know how you turn from that. I don't think it's impossible. I would hate to see the party of Lincoln become a historical side note, but it wouldn't be the first time in American history. Probably won't be the last. So I think the attachment we have to the parties needs to just, you know, loosen a bit. They shift and change over time. We might still call them Democrats and Republicans, but they look very different than they looked even 50 years ago, and that's okay. And I think third party, you know, as we talk about in our How to Be a Citizen series, ranked choice voting could really open up lanes for more parties. And I think that we need, as our country gets bigger and as the future gets more complicated, the idea that we can only have two choices is just not realistic. There needs to be space for centrists. There needs to be safe space for true progressives. There needs to be space for small government conservatives. And I just don't see that right now. And I don't see how that is possible after the damage Donald Trump has done to the Republican Party.
It almost seems more likely to me that that third option would be a progressive party, just because there's sort of a personality driver. You know, the progressive left seems much more likely to organize and activate and develop that sense of, okay, we're in this together, we're doing it, let's go, than people like me. And I think that's okay. I mean, part of what this has taught me about myself, and I don't know if this is going to be relevant to anyone but me, but I can only speak for me, so here I am. What I've learned about myself is, like, I just am not a person who has a strong sense of affiliation. I don't need a party. It was not difficult for me to vote for Evan McMullen because I didn't feel like I owed the Republican Party my vote in 2016. It's not difficult for me to vote for Joe Biden now because I don't find voting for a Democrat to be like some repulsive, weird, out-of-body act. I'm okay being a centrist and kind of floating around. I'm much more likely to be devoted to an issue like criminal justice reform that sometimes is better represented by one party and sometimes the other, but you stay the course on this issue because this issue has, like, a coherent philosophical underpinning. That is much more my personality than getting involved in a party at any level. I don't see a future for myself being influential in government in that way, because I'm not wired that way. And that's fine. Like we talk about on the show all the time, it takes all kinds. And in order for all kinds to do their best work, people like me need to say, cool, like, I shouldn't be in charge because I don't have that. I don't have that thing. And how can I best influence and support the people who do have that thing? That's the bigger question.
Well, join us next week as we start asking really big questions about citizenship. With our How to Be a Citizen series, we'll have lots of extras and bonuses on Patreon. And until Tuesday, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production.
Elise Knapp is our managing director. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers, Tim Miller, Tiffany Hasler, Joshua Allen,
David McWilliams,
Allie Edwards,
Martha Brunitsky,
Amy Whited,
Janice Elliott,
Sarah Ralph,
Barry Kaufman,
Jeremy Sequoia,
Lori Ladau,
Emily Neasley,
Allison Luzader,
Tracy Putoff,
Jared Minson.
To support Pantsuit Politics and receive lots of bonus features, visit patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics.
You can connect with us on our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com, sign up for our weekly emails, and follow us on Instagram.